There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Sunday, November the 3rd. There's a competition going on to find a new brand identity for the UAE. So we're asking you, which countries, tourism campaigns and tourism brands can you recall?
This is what Mohammed says.
When I was a child, I saw the Malaysia Truly Asia campaign. And that was in the 90s, I think. And I had to go there and I went there in 2000. It has a pretty catchy tune and it's stuck in my mind since then.
And it has won multiple awards. In case you haven't heard it, we're going to make it stick in your mind for the rest of today.
Here we have a branding consultant in the studio with us now to talk about this competition. Archie Behrens is Managing Director at communications company Hanover Middle East. Archie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this this competition and this news that there's going to be a new brand identity for the UAE?
I think it's a brilliant idea and it comes at a very, very important time in the nation's history. Several key anniversaries coming up and obviously one of the biggest events in the nation's history. You know, effectively, the button has started on that in the form of Expo 2020, which is obviously a Dubai event. But I think it's already being positioned very much as a national event and all Emirates are going to, you know, take part. I should add here, it's interesting. You described me as a branding consultant. We don't do logos, but I think for a couple of observations on this. One, I think it's brilliant to get the people involved in actually developing the brand rather than paying a company a lot of money to come up with a logo which may or may not go down well. To actually get the people involved is a great initiative and a great idea. I've not come across it before. The second thing, though, that's really important is while you've got you come up with a logo, you come up with something visual, it's what goes with it that's really important. It's a brand needs a mission and a purpose. So what does the country stand for? Yes, it needs to be represented visually, but what action goes with it? What are the sub-brands? What is the narrative that supports that brand? Because the visual image may mean different things to different people. It's all very subjective. But the narrative that goes with it, if it's simple and clear and consistent, will mean the same thing to everybody who receives it and absorbs it.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment and ask why countries need brands in the first place. It's National Flag Day today. Richard's sitting in front of a giant UAE flag this morning. Isn't that branding enough?
Very good question. I think I've been doing a little bit of homework on this and looking at the history of national branding. It's a relatively new phenomenon because, and it's really been born out of globalization because as people in the world become more and more transient and move across the world more readily, there's a greater flow of capital, there's a greater flow of human beings, and every nation is competing for those people, whether it's for their money, whether it's for their talent, whether it's for the businesses to invest in those companies, or whether it's a combination of all three. Countries need to stand out more. So I think that's really it. The answer to your question is that.
How does it differ from branding a product?
Very good question. Flags. I mean, it's interesting. You know, there is the flag sitting, behind Richard on the screen. You talked about flags earlier, briefly on the show, and I mean, it's really interesting. Can you tell the difference, for example, between the flag of Kuwait, the flag of Iraq, and the flag of Egypt? They're all actually quite similar. Can you tell the difference instantly between the flag of Slovakia, the flag of Slovenia, and the flag of Croatia? All very similar. So, if you like, national branding is about what the country stands for. Corporate branding is obviously about a particular product or a very, very specific industry. A national brand is, you know, much more than a single thing.
But it's getting buy-in for it as well, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned similar flags. I come from a country where we did decide a couple of years ago that our flag was a bit too similar to that of the blokes next door. And so we spent $27 million holding a couple of referenda and trying to get the public to design their own flags, which if any New Zealanders are listening, you may remember that gave us Laser Kiwi, which was simply brilliant. What it didn't give us is a new flag because we decided at the end of it that we quite liked the old one.
I followed that quite closely. I was amazed by it because, of course, what you haven't mentioned is of course, both your flag and the guys next door both have another flag within it, which to me always sort of is redolent of colonialism, which both countries are very, very keen to get away from. So I was really surprised that the referendum actually delivered a keep the flag result. They'd never done it in Australia. I would imagine if they did, you'd have a big lobby to change it.
So what challenges do come with rebranding? What does the UAE need to keep in mind at this point?
Simplicity. Back up the logo with a very, very clear narrative. Engage with all the people around the world. And to be fair to the UAE, they are doing that. I mean, you know, not many weeks go by where there isn't a delegation either to a country or receiving other countries in here. So, but that needs to continue. And that dialogue needs to happen. They need to be more visible in other countries. So when that logo is produced, I would expect it to be accompanied not just by a, you know, great, obviously there will be a great unveiling, of course there will, but there's the narrative that supports it needs to be very clear, and there needs to be a lot of engagement over it.
Archie, what do you make of what Saudi Arabia has done with its tourism rebrand over the past few weeks or so? They've had the hashtag Where in the World. And certainly the campaign, which is not exactly the same as a national logo or identity, but their campaign has been This is not Bali. And a picture of a scene of green hills that kind of looks like Bali but isn't. This is not Siberia. This is not the Caribbean. What do you make of that?
I think, it's obviously been, as you say, a very aggressive campaign. I guess, you know, like so many of these campaigns, will it be, you know, how do you judge it? Is it a good campaign? You can only judge its success by what it delivers. So if you ask me that question in 2 years' time and there's been a significant, a huge uptick in the number of people visiting Saudi Arabia for tourism purposes alone, then it will have worked. But you won't know that until that happens. The other thing, of course, is, I mean, it's, yes, the campaign, but all the supporting action that goes with it. And, you know, again, I go back to, you know, what do you do in support of a campaign? It's the actions you take. So Saudi Arabia has made it much easier to obtain a tourist visa and to arrive on a whim almost. Yeah, right, National Day holiday, you mentioned. So, right, what are we going to do? Are we going to stay here? Are we going to go, oh, let's go to Saudi Arabia? How easy is it to do that? Increasingly easy is what I'm hearing, and that's great.
What campaigns do you think nationally have worked? What do you think have been some of the best over the years?
Well, I mean, sorry to sort of not be original because you mentioned it already, but I thought the Australian one of the late 80s, early 90s was superb. And actually, I think the more recent one is not as good. You know, Australia very much had that image of the sort of larrikin.
But it has a Hemsworth.
Well, I just, maybe it's my age, I just preferred that one. And I had visited Australia at the time and was very taken by that campaign. I didn't like the Indian one so much. I've got to be honest about that.
You're not alone, Archie. Anthony has written in saying best tourism advert, Paul Hogan in the 80s, throw another shrimp in the Barbie. So Archie, for you and for Anthony, and frankly for me, because he gets my vote as well, this is it.
G'day, viewers. Just been telling the Yanks how Australia's the best place for a holiday and the friendliest place on earth.
The beaches are crisp and clean and there's plenty of shrimps on the Barbie. The least we can do is make sure everyone's smiling.
I'm not asking you to rent out the spare bedroom or anything. Just flash the pearly whites and say g'day to a visitor.
G'day.
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 The irony not lost on Brandy about the rise of Airbnb.
Yeah, we are now asking you to rent out your spare room to a visitor. Do you have to be careful, though, when you're playing on really blatant national stereotypes like that?
Mm. Yeah, you know, that is true, but... Yes, it is a very, very fine line to tread. I mean, it's interesting because actually Australia, you think, when you think of, you know, what is the first thing that comes into your mind when you think Australia? To me, it's sport. That is because I am a very keen sportsman and I love watching all types of sport. And Australia, among other nations, excel in it.
So before we let you go, Archie, if this wasn't being decided by artists in a competition, if they'd walked into Hanover and said, come up with a brand for us, what would you be including in it?
Well, the first thing, what do they want it to include? What do they see? You have to, you know, I think you'd be talking focus groups, you'd be talking, effectively that's what they've done, is effectively created a mini focus group. But that's what I would certainly encourage them to do. What do you want it to stand for? And how, I go back again, sorry to repeat this point, how are you going to support it with actions and words? That to me is it almost starts from there, because rather than just coming up with something and then working out what it stands for, you need to work out what you want to stand for in the first place.
Archie Behrens, Managing Director at Communications Company Hanover Middle East. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me again.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's talk about that big automotive merger. Fiat Chrysler, the big Italian-American organisation, agreeing over the weekend, as expected, to a merger with Peugeot, the French company. Vitaly Bielski is with us in the studio. He's a senior consultant with the mobility practice at Frost & Sullivan. So tell us about this deal. What do we know so far?
Essentially, what we know is two large companies are going to merge, and they are going to create about a single company which is likely to sell about more than 8 million vehicles globally, close to 9 million vehicles globally. Both companies are similar in a lot of ways, but they're also different in many, many ways. So that's going to be quite a difficult merger, and we're just about to see what are the options these companies are going to go for when it comes to the way they're going to structure the business.
They did announce some of the terms of the deal. $48 billion is the ticket price that's being put on it. And the rationale they're saying is to help spread the huge cost of developing two things. One, electric vehicles, and two, autonomous vehicles. Let's have a listen to the boss of Peugeot, PSA Group as it's known, the French company. He's Carlos Tavares. This is him speaking, not this weekend, but previously, about the outlook for electric vehicle sales.
I think it's still a challenge for us to forecast that kind of thing. I think it's obvious that people are now getting used to electric vehicles. They are looking for the charging network. They are expecting a higher density of this charging network. And I think that the pickup on pure electric vehicles will depend on affordability. That's clearly one of the expectations, on the range and on the density of the charging network. Those are the three things that need to be aligned for the consumers to feel comfortable.
So explain, Vitaly, the challenge facing companies like Fiat Chrysler, like Peugeot and others when it comes to, let's look at electric first of all.
Well, essentially building electric vehicles is a completely new thing for most automotive manufacturers. They're not good at that. They require huge investments when it comes to building batteries, building motors, electric motors. And they don't necessarily have expertise in that. So if you have to do it on your own, it's going to take time. It's going to take enormous funds to do it. And that's what many companies are going to... They're looking for partners. Essentially, everybody's looking for partners. If you are going... to be honest, I think it's more than just electric vehicles. That's why they're merging. That's why they want to create a single company. But when it comes to just electric vehicles, you always need a partner, because it's not just vehicles. It's batteries. It's charging stations. It's general infrastructure, and it's new technology which none of these companies is really good at.
The other thing is autonomous vehicles. Batteries, we know it's here. It's coming. You can buy a battery-powered car today. People are listening to this radio show now in a Tesla or a Chevrolet or a Nissan. But the autonomous thing, fully autonomous, level 5 autonomy, seems to be a long, long way away from a technical perspective, but also from a regulatory safety perspective. Tell us where we stand with autonomy.
Well, you're completely right. If we're talking about level 5 autonomy, it's still ahead of us. I would say about 5 to 10 years ahead. So it's going to take time to develop the technology and regulations to bring these vehicles on road. But most of the manufacturers are now looking at level 3 and possibly level 4 going ahead. And that's where the cooperation is going to happen. That's where we see that it's going to start. Definitely similar to electric vehicles, when it comes to autonomous vehicles, most manufacturers necessarily do require support. They do require partners, and that's similar in case of PSA and FCA.
We've seen numerous partnerships between car makers, and tech companies tying up to try and get this right. Do you think we'll see any more mergers, or do we need to?
I think we will see more, not necessarily the same magnitude or the same size, but we'll definitely see more partnerships. FCA and PSA are already mature companies. These are big companies with more than close to four, in case of PSA, million vehicles being sold every year globally. In case of FCA, it's more than 5 million vehicles. So these are big companies, and merging these companies is a huge task. I'm not sure what's the rate of success is going to be. When it comes to other companies, we will see. I'm sure that we will see more mergers. Maybe not the same size, but of similar nature.
Because car companies are really trying to figure out what kind of future they have, aren't they? Who they're even going to be selling to, who their customers
That's
are going
right.
to be.
Yeah, because car manufacturers these days are not necessarily just car makers. They're also mobility players. And when we're talking about mobility, we're talking about shared mobility. We're talking about personal mobility, corporate mobility. We're talking about autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles. And most of these things are not in the core business of these companies as of today. They need to grow outside of their core capabilities, and that's something which they are not too certain about.
What does it mean for us here in the UAE? We know, for example, that Dubai in particular has all kinds of strategies when it comes to the future of mobility. It has targets for self-driving cars by 2030. Just remind us what those targets are here and how a deal like this might eventually impact us here.
Yeah, so the targets here locally is about 25% of all transport has to be autonomous by 2030, and that's the biggest, I would say, goal. And when it comes to electric vehicles, RTA is doing a lot of, is putting a lot of effort into developing electric vehicles, but we still don't have, I would say, strict targets or strict goals when it comes to penetration of electric vehicles here. So that's going to take some time. When it comes to autonomous, one thing which Dubai needs is definitely a global partner. When it comes to supplier of autonomous vehicles, it can be any company, it can be any player in the world today. And one thing which Dubai can do is Dubai does not necessarily have to develop autonomous vehicles, be it with a partner or without a partner, but Dubai can become a test bed for autonomous vehicles. So what we see globally is cities and countries are becoming, and we're moving towards cities rather than countries as of now, and cities are trying to develop their capabilities when it comes to new mobility.
Vitaly, one question. This is being seen as led by Peugeot, and their CEO, who we just heard about, Carlos Tavares, is seen as one of the kind of pioneers and driving forces in the auto industry at the moment. Is he missing a trick by merging one old-fashioned traditional car company with two other old-fashioned traditional car companies? Should he not be doing a deal with Google's Waymo or Uber or a tech company?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I was asking myself the same. As you said, there's two mature companies. Their footprint is similar in a lot of ways. What my thinking is, what they're trying to go for is the scale. Obviously, many companies say that scale is overrated. It's not necessarily about the size of the company. It's more about profitability. But I do think that PSA is all about optimizing their business, and for that, they need scale. They have been quite successful with Opel. Brand, and they're trying to do the same with FCA probably. What they are might be interested
in is Fiat Chrysler.
Fiat Chrysler, yes. What they might be interested in Chrysler is their footprint in the US, in the US market, because if we look at Fiat Chrysler, it's not about European business. More than half of their vehicle sales is coming from the US market, and it's highly profitable market. So they're selling, it's about Jeep vehicles, it's about Ram, it's about Dodge, and those are highly profitable because those are 4x4 and pickups. And in PSA does not necessarily have good capability in that area.
Vitaly, appreciate your time. Senior consultant in the mobility practice at Frost & Sullivan. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We're talking mergers. We've just been getting the auto analysts' take on Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot agreeing to become one this weekend to create the world's fourth largest car company. We're going to find out what makes a successful merger in general now with Abdullah Matawi, who's a partner and head of the corporate commercial practice at the law firm Al Tamimi. Abdullah, it's lovely to have you in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There's an often sort of trounced out statement that the majority of mergers actually fail. How true is that?
I think statistically it probably is true. You know, the analogy that I frequently like to think about is, you know, two parties that have equal power and equal weight, typically speaking, will want to get together, usually to consolidate and create market scale. But there has to be chemistry. So in any marriage, like a merger, there has to be chemistry. And the ones that have failed have typically failed either because somebody's paid too much, but more often because of lack of chemistry.
What are the danger points in a merger? What are the biggest challenges? I mean, you've said chemistry there, that's very broad. But when a merger falls over, what actually generally happens?
Well, I mean, in this particular deal, you're still in this period where the two companies have announced publicly that they're going to do a deal. Although it's still premature to say that with any certainty, because there are a number of things that are going to be happening over the next 45 to 60 days to get the deal across the line. And it's during that period where things will come up and bubble up, either at the shareholder level in the two separate companies or in the broader environment. For example, political discussions, trade union discussions, merger authorities looking at the deal. So lots of different things can be going on in this period leading up to a binding agreement actually happening. And during that period, a lot of these kind of cultural and chemistry issues can come to the surface as well.
Who decides, or how does a company decide what the outward-facing merged entity looks like? Whose company name gets to live on or go at the front of the portmanteau? Who gets to lead it?
That's a good question. So, I mean, this deal in particular is being described as a merger of equals, and on the face of it, the two companies look very similar in terms of revenue and size and balance sheets and so on. But in every deal of this nature, there's always going to be one party that's a little bit more in control. In this one, it looks like PSA is the company that's more in control and, you know, to some degree is a little bit taking over Fiat Chrysler. So it's the one that has that little bit extra power, or the one that's going to be valuing the other one higher.
Well, you've been involved in a lot of high-profile mergers. Is ego often an issue?
Is ego... Oh, ego's always an issue, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in this particular case, you've got some quite concentrated shareholdings in both of the companies. The Agnelli family in Fiat Chrysler, for example, I think owns about 30% of the shares, but controls nearly half of the voting rights.
So let's look at what happens here in the Gulf. We've had a number of big high-profile mergers lately, particularly in banks here in the UAE. We had the FAB created, another big merger down the road in Abu Dhabi. In what ways are mergers here different and unique, and in what ways do they follow just the same pattern as everywhere else in the world?
So, I mean, my team is actually working on quite a big bank merger at the moment, and in the banking...
Is there three parties involved by any chance?
I can't possibly say.
Go on, we won't tell anyone, no one's listening.
Yeah, so, look, I mean, you know, banking as an industry is a regulated industry, so there are going to be additional stakeholders involved in approving a deal, figuring out whether the companies should sit together and so on. But otherwise, in the region here, no. I mean, mergers and acquisitions tend to follow a similar pattern to what they do in many other places. I think perhaps one area of law that has been traditionally underdeveloped but is certainly developing very rapidly is the competition side of M&A. Clearly, one of the downsides, you could say, to M&A from a consumer perspective is that when companies merge, they concentrate power in the market. They potentially create... lack of competition. So, I mean, that's something that that we're seeing more and more of. We recently, our competition law team recently got a clearance for Uber to do its merger with Careem, and that was a great result because Uber's facing trouble in other parts of the world in getting those types of clearances. But otherwise, no. I mean, M&A in the region tends to follow the same pattern as it does in most places.
Abdullah Matawi, partner and head of the corporate commercial practice at Al Tamimi. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
Starting Brandy Scott with this.
Oh my God. Look at them tires. They are so big.
I have learnt of a tire hotel this weekend. I did not know that such a thing existed.
I saw Pirelli in your list of stories, and I have to say immediately, word association, Pirelli does not equal tires. Pirelli equals calendar to me. Tell me about the hotel.
Dubai has a Pirelli tire hotel. We're one of only four in the world, Monte Carlo, Los Angeles, and Munich. Who knew that your tyres needed somewhere to go on holiday? Apparently they do. It has custom designed racks that are set up in order to basically make your tyres live longer and healthier. It's on Hesse Street near the Autodrome. Where else would it be? You can check your tyres, and particularly if you are apparently a vintage car owner, because flat spots on cars that aren't driven very much is an issue with tyres. This apparently prevents that.
Right, who pays for the hotel?
Presumably the car owner. And presumably the person who is checking their tyres into a Pirelli tyre hotel has enough money to be able to do such things.
I bizarrely, I do have Pirelli tyres on my car. There is no way on this planet I'm going to pay for them to go and stay in this place.
My question is, if you put your tyres into a Pirelli tyre hotel, presumably that means you have another four tyres that you can put on your car. You're not leaving it on milk crates outside the hotel, are you? No, you're not.
On so many levels, this is just not happening. So many deals, the Fiat Chrysler slash Peugeot deal has been confirmed. That's going ahead. That's a megabucks deal. But we're more excited about a far smaller deal. Not $2 trillion, but a piddling $2 billion. This is Google and Fitbit, Brandy, isn't it?
Yeah, this is. Google and Fitbit finally announcing, and this has been, again, been the talks had been talked about for a couple of days, coming out this weekend saying that Google's going to be buying Fitbit $2.1 billion. In a deal. A lot of concerns about this and a lot of questions about what it means for Apple as well. And that's been the big one for a lot of analysts. Fitbit, you could argue, was really the first big name in the game. Founded in 2007, they've sold over 100 million Fitbits since then. They may no longer be the trendiest, but did you know Facebook, allegedly, according to The Information, which is an online sort of news site that publishes a lot of rumours as well as news about tech, Facebook went in and bid for Fitbit before Google got it.
Did they?
Allegedly so.
Do we know how much they offered?
Roughly half is what is said to have been offered.
Because Fitbit has really fallen from grace over the past 4 years. I'm looking at a chart of its share price. And back in the summer of 2015, 4 years ago, it was $50 a share. And before yesterday's takeover deal, it was languishing at around about $5 a share, $5.50 a share. So from 50 to 5.5, it had lost 90% of its value over 4 years.
Here's my take on it. If you are a software company or a social media company or what have you, if you're watching what's happening to Apple recently, and we've just had Apple's numbers out in the last couple of days, they were better than expected. When did they come out? Wednesday. Better than expected.
Yep.
One of the things driving it, not the iPhone, but the wearables, the Apple Watch. You can see the wearable space opening up. Is it easier to buy a wearable, a name that people like and trust, and then soup it up to basically make it into an Apple competitor? Obviously, Google thinks it is.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It's not a huge amount of money. And they're getting a serious brand and an awful lot of data. So, yeah, most analysts are cheering this one. But the deals are getting smaller and smaller, from the $50 billion Fiat Peugeot merger to the $2 billion Google Fitbit deal to this.
A chance to grow stronger. An opportunity to push yourself. Room to beat your best. The mirror is a window to a fitness experience the world has never seen before.
Mirror is a thing you stick on your wall, but it's also a thing that will stream exercise classes for you. This is a startup. September 2018, I think, is when it launched in New York. An interactive workout mirror has just raised $34 million. Two of the investors, Kylie Kloss, the supermodel, and Lululemon, the
Fitly
Active People, which is the one that's got everyone talking. We don't know how much Lululemon has put into Mirror, but it is found to be interesting that the company that pretty much has become YogaWear is looking at this interactive startup.
Okay.
Peloton, of course, we saw was held up as one of the it's not quite a unicorn, is it, Peloton? But
it was a unicorn
until it went public.
Public, yeah.
That then was
now
involved.
It's just an overvalued public company rather than an overvalued private company.
Exactly. A few weeks before WeWork, Peloton's share price tanked after listing. And people sort of said, yeah, you see what's happened to this tech bubble then. Mirror is similar in that you get to do workouts at home that feel like they're part of a class. But this is workouts where when you look in the mirror, when you turn it on with the app, it's a fitness instructor doing something back at you so you can follow all of their moves, if you like. Clearly, Lululemon sees a future in that. They're going to be offering their own classes and ambassadors doing meditation sessions and everything else on the device. $1,500 for one of the mirrors. Would you buy one?
No. I've got an $8 a month subscription with Les Mills, your guys from New Zealand, and that does me just fine.
Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.